On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. This is Maryland Morning. Ramifications, repercussions, and ruminations on two decisions. The acquittal of Officer Caesar Goodson in Baltimore and the exit from the European Union in Great Britain. Prosecutors have failed to get convictions in the first three trials of officers charged in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. What are their chances moving forward? How will the Goodson verdict affect the suits that five officers have filed against state's attorney Marilyn Mosby? And what will the verdict mean for efforts to build trust between police and communities of color? Edward Smith, David Jaros, and WIPR's Kenneth Burns join me for Maryland Morning on the Law. Plus, the stunning Brexit vote in the UK. Sydney Van Morgan, who directs the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins, on what the vote to leave the EU means for those of us on this side of the pond. Gil Sandler has a Baltimore story first, this hour's news.
I'm producer Rob Sivak. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Justice for Freddie Gray!
Justice for Freddie Gray!
Put those killer cops away!
Put those killer cops away!
What's the problem?
Hold that system!
What's the solution?
Revolution!
It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. We begin today with analysis of the verdict in the trial of Officer Caesar Goodson, the 17-year veteran of the Baltimore City Police Department, who was acquitted on all charges he had faced in connection to the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. Yesterday morning, Judge Barry Williams issued his verdict to a packed courtroom in Courthouse East on Calvert Street. Goodson was the third police officer to be tried. His acquittal follows a hung jury in the case of William Porter, who is scheduled to be retried in September, and an acquittal on four misdemeanor counts for Officer Edward Nero. To unpack what happened in that packed courtroom yesterday, we turn once again to our legal eagles, Edward Smith and David Jaros. Edward Smith is an attorney in private practice. He has served in the office of the state's attorney, and he has argued cases in front of the Supreme Court. David Jaros is an associate professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, whose scholarly focus is on criminal law. He was in the courtroom yesterday, along with Kenneth Burns, who joins us as well. Kenny has been covering all of the trials for WIPR and NPR. Gentlemen, it's good to see you all. Thank you for
coming. Good morning.
Good morning, Tom.
So let's just start. Let me just sort of run the table here, and Eddie, we'll start with you. What's your reaction to this verdict and to how this trial played out over the last week and a half?
Well, my reaction is finality. We needed it. We need it for all of these cases in order to heal and to go forward. Secondly, it's men who we invest with the decision-making authority for us made a decision, and that decision was that this gentleman was not guilty. That is something that I accept, as all citizens must accept, and they have to move on. And we had a prosecutor who decided that she was going to take a bold step to prosecute what she believed was a crime. That's it.
And the judge disagreed.
There you go.
Yeah.
It happens.
Yeah. David Jaros, you followed the trial. You were there yesterday.
I think it was not a great surprise to those who were following the trial closely and listening to the evidence. And I think it's important to recognize that at the end of the day, the burden was significant. Not only was it that each element of the crime had to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but that the elements themselves required more than mere negligence, more than just a finding that Officer Goodson had violated policy, that he had put Freddie Gray's life in danger, but that he had done that with a conscious disregard for the risk, that he was aware of the risk and he disregarded it. That was a significant hurdle for the prosecution, and absent more evidence of a rough ride, I think the state just had too hard a time proving that case.
Yeah, and Kenny Burns, this whole notion of a rough ride kind of got blown up in Judge Williams' verdict, didn't it?
And you really saw a preview of that during the closing arguments earlier in the week, where the judge really pressed the prosecution. Show me how it's a rough ride. Does this make it a rough ride? Show me how this is a rough ride, because you put it out there to the point during the verdict. He called it an inflammatory term that required definition. And even during the trial, the only person that really provided anything close to a definition was Sanford O'Neill Franklin. And even he said, and keep in mind, he's a state witness, there were no characteristics of a rough ride in the evidence. And then the verdict overall, I think the state will have a hard time moving forward because it addressed two things, the rough ride theory and trying to convict officers on a general order. And the judge said case law, ample case law has shown that filing a general order does not necessarily rise to the level of criminal negligence.
And Ed Smith, you've defended police officers both in trials and in police review boards. And we should note that Officer Goodson is still subject to an administrative review in the police department.
By a trial board, yes.
The trial board. So his future with the police department is by no means guaranteed, right? He's going to have his own, quote unquote, rough ride when he gets to the trial board.
He's on a slippery slope. There's no doubt about that. There's a different standard, obviously, at a trial board than there is. And the commissioner has the ultimate determination, even if the trial board says that he didn't do anything wrong, to determine whether or not the police commissioner wants him as an officer, as an individual, to represent his police department out in the community.
What about the other officers, the other five? Are they all going to be subject to an administrative trial review board as well?
They may be. They have counsel, and counsel obviously gives them advice as to what they see in the charges and specifications, which the officers must have notice of and must be duly served with. And if there is a decision made to move forward on trial boards, then they constitute a trial board with people on the wheel who the police commissioner appoints, and they go to it. So all five may face it, or maybe four, maybe three, maybe two, mm-hmm. but certainly we know one that will.
Yeah, certainly. And Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake took pains to mention the fact that Officer Goodson still has to, go through that process. So that she made mention of the fact that the process is not over. Dave Jarosz, when I read the verdict, it was kind of stunning to me, in which the judge says that the court is presented with a number of equally plausible scenarios, meaning that clearly he found that the state did not meet its burden of proof that their scenario was, unequivocally the one that played out. Given that universe of plausible scenarios, what did the prosecution need to do to make their theory of the case pop higher than the other ones?
Well, there were really two issues. One was they were committed to showing that the injury occurred before the fifth stop, before the stop right before they arrived at the Western District. And in order to do that, they relied heavily on the testimony of the state's medical examiner. And the defense countered with their own experts. And at the end of the day, having sat through the trial, I could not conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that we know exactly when Mr. Gray suffered his fatal injury. And I think the judge also said there were coherent arguments that were believable of what could have happened. But of course, at the end of the day, the standard is not what could have happened, but what did he believe beyond a reasonable doubt. Additionally, the fact that there was an allegation of a rough ride was not itself enough. It's important to note here, though, that the judge finding that there's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt does not mean nothing happened. It doesn't mean even that a rough ride did not occur. It means that there wasn't evidence from which the judge could conclude that the elements existed beyond a reasonable doubt. And so I think the case revealed a great deal about what's going on in Baltimore with police, particularly the police in poor communities. And, the next step is to ask, is prosecutions and the criminal justice system the way to start to grapple with those issues? Or do we look to other areas? But certainly there's a problem that needs to be dealt with.
Yeah, and the situation certainly has changed, Kenny. I mean, from a year ago when State's Attorney Mosby made these charges, it was very dramatic. It seemed to quell the violence that was going on at that time. She was, roundly applauded for she charged a police officer with murder. And this was unlike Ferguson. This is unlike other jurisdictions. But boy, difference a year makes.
Well, is it really not like Ferguson? Because even though we have black leadership in Baltimore City, we're still dealing with the same issues as Ferguson. I mean, keep that in mind. And also, I kind of want to back up to the scenarios because, David, you and I talked about this before. It came down to which medical experts were believable. And based on my reading of the tea leaves, the judge believed all of them, but he needed something to prove or something to actually put the proof to actually play out which scenario was believable. All of them were believable, but there is not one bit of evidence that makes one of the five scenarios that the judge discussed more believable than the other.
Yeah. That's Kenny Burns from WIPR's reporting staff. He's our Metro reporter. Dave Jarrows from the University of Baltimore is here, and Ed Smith, an attorney in private practice here as well. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Eddie, one of the charges in which for which Officer Goodson and all the other and Officer Nero were acquitted was misconduct in office. There is a 25-year-old, reasonably healthy man arrested by the police, put into a van, and a week later he's dead. There has some misconduct, it appears, has taken place. Yet the prosecution has yet to be able to prove misconduct in at least these two cases, and they got a hung jury on the in the third instance. This guy died in the custody of the police. Is it simply a matter of that this was a terrible accident, that no one person is responsible or no group of people is responsible? Or is it simply that as a legal matter, prosecutors have yet to be able to prove that malfeasance and misconduct took place?
Well, there are two different standards here, and we normally go to the outcome. There was a death, somebody must have been responsible criminally. It's not the situation. There was a death, it could have been negligence, civil negligence. And obviously there was a settlement in this case that went to that negligence. You can't get your pound of flesh if you can't prove your case beyond a reasonable doubt, as Dave has already indicated. And that's the problem. I think we have to think about this, not globally, but we have to think about it specifically as to what occurred and what the standard of proof is. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt that there was misfeasance or malfeasance in office, and that Judge Williams found did not occur.
Yeah, Dave.
And part of that charge, that misconduct charge, it's a little misleading, because I must admit the first time I heard it, I thought, well, it's misconduct if you violate a policy, right? But it's to corruptly fail to do your duty, and that word corruptly is important. That means.
And the judge talks about that in his.
The judge talked about, in fact,
what that means.
I think I differed with the judge even a little bit on what it meant. He said it was simply willful. I think it requires even a little bit more malice than that. But I think there's a deep irony here, which is that if human beings are being shuttled through the system essentially callously and without thought, then that is an indictment of the entire system, but ironically might mean that the officers themselves didn't have the requisite conscious intent or awareness of the risk, at least, to make them guilty.
Our legal analyst, attorney Edward Smith and University of Baltimore law professor David Jarrows, join me in the studio along with Kenneth Burns, WIPR's Metro reporter. We should note as well, Catherine Rents in The Sun reporting that as the news of the acquittal in the death of Freddie Gray was, you know, digested by folks around the country and around the world, a very close friend of Freddie Gray, a gentleman named Donzel Canada, they called him Zelly, was killed the day before in Baltimore, another 27-year-old African-American man. A victim of violence on Baltimore streets. He was the 127th homicide this year in Baltimore. Kenny, this trial seemed to have more fireworks than the trial of Edward Nero, for example, or the trial of Officer Porter, for example. As you sat there in that courtroom for these last couple of weeks, what struck you as moments that were, you know, particularly unexpected?
Hands down, one of the lead detectives in the case calling out prosecutors for not looking at all of the evidence or taking all of the evidence with them. The prosecutors accusing the lead detective of sabotaging the case to the point that Michael Schatzo, the chief deputy state's attorney, effectively the number two guy in the state's attorney's office, bring it up in court that he asked this detective to step down or remove the detective from the case because he believes there were sabotages. And the judge several times needing to interrupt the testimony before it got a little too heated. And so this is where you really saw the dirty laundry, as I like to say, about what happened during this investigation leading up to the first pretrial motion involving all of the officers that September.
Yeah. And Dave, we had revelations, Justin Fenton in The Sun reporting a couple of days ago that appears the one of the top folks in the sheriff's office who was putatively involved in the investigation that Marilyn Mosby's office did, so-called parallel investigation between them and the police prior to bringing charges against all of these officers. He basically said he didn't have all that much to do with it. What does that mean?
Well, for one, I'd agree with Ken. You know, this is airing dirty laundry, but I don't think it's just the dirty laundry of this case. To be perfectly honest, I think we're airing the dirty laundry of the criminal justice system. And what we've seen throughout this trial are some of the problems that are endemic in the system and that really require reform and change. We've heard about prosecutors who are alleged to have failed to turn over exculpatory information. Now, to be perfectly honest, we had a defendant who the officers were sympathetic towards in this case, so the police waved a flag and said, this happened here. You got to ask yourself what happens in every other case where the police don't necessarily come forward and say, hey, we had exculpatory information. So I think that strikes fear in the heart, I think, of every defendant about what's going on in their cases. We've got questions about whether or not the police are really going to actively investigate their own. We've got evidence coming out that whether or not a rough ride occurred in this case, it occurs in other areas of the city. We've got the state's attorney acknowledging that officers routinely, quote unquote, jack up Baltimore citizens without probable cause or reasonable suspicion. So I and we have this now evidence that the sheriff was not nearly as involved in an investigation that was supposed to be thorough as we had been told. All of this, I think, suggests we need to look very hard about how the criminal justice system is operating in the city and make some really intense reforms.
And in addition to that, you have the police and their training practices put on trial three times: the Porter trial, the Nero trial, and this current trial, the Goodson trial. We don't know if officers are reading general orders. We don't know if the general orders are being read aloud during roll call. We don't know what officers are being trained on, if they're being trained on how to secure a prisoner in a transport van. We're learning that the transport vans, up until recently, they just had the cameras, but they didn't record anything. And in this trial, the camera wasn't even working, if I recall correctly. So if you're following the trail from the time that people are arrested through the courts, you're seeing all this dirty laundry, so to speak, and all these issues that are airing out over three high-profile trials.
Yeah, and Eddie, you mentioned this earlier in the show. There are different standards in different situations. These general orders where police officers are instructed to, you know, handle prisoners in a particular way or suspects in a particular way. If the officers, for whatever reason, don't obey those general orders, that's not necessarily, and Judge Williams made this clear in his verdict, that's not necessarily a violation of the law. That's a violation of the rules of the police department.
Yeah, we're dealing with human beings here, and we each have our perspective when we are faced with a situation on how to deal with it. And perhaps what we ought to be a little bit more pensive about is the quality of the human beings that we put in charge in the criminal justice system and their ability to take in sensory perceptions when they're faced with danger, when they're faced with situation, and how they deal with them. Maybe more psychological training is necessary. Maybe more experience is necessary when you're dealing with incendiary situations out on the street. Because let's face it, sometimes our citizens don't act with the best of all etiquette and caring. And these people out in the street are faced with some pretty horrible situations. We had over 300 homicides last year. The pressure on these people to go out every day and to put their lives on the line is great. So what we probably need is at the front end to look at these people and say, look, can you do the job or can't you? We're paying you to do the job. What is it that we need in an individual to be in this kind of situation? Because unfortunately, the public's not going to change. The people who commit the murders are not going to change. The people who are out there who have the mental illnesses, some of them are not going to change. And we need to understand and break that down. We just can't blame it on the system itself, because we need a system. We just need
a more perfect person to deal with this.
And Commissioner Davis has certainly made a point of those very things, saying that, you know, he's concerned, for example, that the median age of police officers is so young. It's in the mid-20s. He's concerned that many of them don't live in the city of Baltimore. Officer Goodson lives in Catonsville, for example. Now, he's close to the city of Baltimore. He's on the west side.
It ain't the city, though.
You know, but it ain't the city. You know? Close is only good in horseshoes.
In horseshoes,
you know?
There you go.
Hand grenades.
And I heard Cornell Brooks, the president of the NAACP, talking about this case, and he talked about Cincinnati and the success that they've had in reforming their police department and the shift from what is a warrior mentality to what is a guardian mentality. And there are reforms happening across the country that are changing how police operate in the community. I think that's something that can happen in Baltimore. I think there are reasons to hope that that this tragedy will spur those kinds of reforms. It is also worth recognizing that there are efforts to reform that are being fought pretty bitterly. It is, I think, notable that at the very same time these cases are being litigated in criminal court and people are saying this is not a crime, this was maybe mere negligence, that at the same time there's a lawsuit blocking a civilian review board from operating in Baltimore and even providing feedback to the police department about complaints. And so if we're not going to use the criminal justice system, we certainly need to look to other mechanisms to make sure the community feels safe.
Dave Jaros from the University of Baltimore School of Law joins us in the studio, along with Ed Smith, an attorney in private practice, and Kenneth Burns, who is our Metro reporter here at WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. So Dave makes an interesting point that is the criminal justice system the best way, or perhaps even some people might think the only way of reforming the system, whether it is or not. Marilyn Mosby has charged these six officers. There's a lot of chatter now, a lot of pressure, I'd say, on State's Attorney Mosby to drop the charges in the remaining four cases.
And Lieutenant Gene Ryan, the president of the FOP, is leading that charge. He said yesterday it's basically a waste of time to pursue the charges against the remaining four officers. Remember, Officer Porter's going to get retried. Yeah. So we're
luckily he wasn't elected by the citizens of Baltimore.
Yeah,
right.
But Ryan, you can sort of almost understand. I mean, he's obviously representing the police. They'd like to have this whole thing go away. But, you know, the Baltimore Sun came out with an editorial just a couple of hours after the verdict, very, very strong, saying, you know, that Ms. Mosby needs to reevaluate whether proceeding with these prosecutions does any good and makes any sense. Certainly, Kenny, everybody seems to think that proceeding with the prosecutions is going to be really hard if they were not able to get a conviction, at least in the Goodson and Nero trial.
Just going through the verdict is going to be especially hard considering the two main prongs that the state used to, as far as their prosecutorial theory, got torpedoed by the judge. The use of the general order and then particularly the rough ride and the failure to seatbelt. They tried, in particular, the seatbelt theory was used twice in the Nero trial and in this trial. And both times the judge said, okay, maybe he forgot or he just didn't do it on purpose, but it doesn't necessarily rise to criminal negligence. He was negligent, but he could have been forgetful at the same time. There's also questions going back to last year. Did she rush this going forward? Did they do a proper investigation? Did they look at all the evidence? And anybody that happened to watch the part of the trial between the detective and the prosecution, it appears that no one, that the prosecutors didn't look at all the evidence, or they only looked at what they wanted to look at to support their theory. But now you have a lot of questions. But at the end of the day, I really think that State's Attorney Mosby will probably be safe after all of this because she actually did something. She, thinking about all the cases, Ferguson, Cincinnati, Chicago, Cleveland, she actually was bold enough to bring it to a judge. This is what happened.
But I don't know, Dave. I mean, she's brought these charges, but, you know, has it now come to light that, you know, these charges just aren't going to stick?
Well, I think after this case, there's no question they're going to have to go back and they're going to have to reassess and decide not what they believe happened. They may well believe a crime occurred, but whether or not they have the evidence to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt in court. The only issue I would take with the Baltimore Sun editorial is part of that editorial said, you know, that Marilyn Mosby should be rethinking this in part because of the harm done to the relationship between the prosecutor's office and the police. And I think it's important that the prosecutors not be so concerned about ruffling the feathers of the police officers that when they do have the evidence of actual of a crime, that they are hesitant to go forward. If there's been one complaint across the country, it's that prosecutors have been a little too cozy with the police and been unwilling to pursue these kind of cases. But I do think that given what they have to prove in court, they have to reassess.
It should be noted that Gene Ryan said that the relationship between cops and prosecutors has not been strained. He said that during the news conference yesterday.
Does anybody believe that?
Maybe he does.
Yeah. I mean, he can say that, and that's lovely, but what are the chances that that's true?
The saying is actions speak louder than words. So I'll just leave it there.
I think that's true, but I also think that everyone recognizes that there's a difference between the line prosecutor who's trying cases every day, who works hand-in-hand with the police, and perhaps what's happening at the upper levels.
Right.
In other words, everybody needs to grow up and put on their big boy and big girl pants and understand that there are differences in human beings, and we make decisions sometimes that may not be the best decisions, but we have to get on with what we have to do in order to meet the objective.
Well, you know, the Sun did say in its editorial yesterday that Ms. Mosby's job is not to mount prosecutions to placate the public. It's to follow the evidence, which seems pretty self-evident.
That's a catch-22, you know, though. Yeah.
But they also say that announcing serious charges may have been reasonable last May, but continuing to pursue them now isn't.
But that's the catch-22 as far as Mrs. Mosby's position as a state's attorney. She's a lawyer, and she's bound by certain ethical obligations. But at the same time, she's elected by the people, which makes her, in part, a politician. So she has to tread that line very carefully, and we saw last year that even though the judge was concerned of how the charges were announced on the steps of the war memorial, he thought that the charges were worth being at least playing out in court a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Ed Smith, five of the six officers, interestingly, not Officer Goodson, who has had a strategy throughout of not talking much. I mean, he did not give a statement to investigators. He did not testify at his trial. He has kept his mouth shut. Five of the six, the other ones, have all filed a suit against State's Attorney Mosby. Does this verdict have any impact on the future of that suit? Because you have mentioned before, as we've talked about this, that Ms. Mosby, as a public official, has a certain amount of immunity from suits like this.
First of all, the results in a criminal case cannot be used in a civil case to prove by preponderance of the evidence that any one of the torts brought should be sustained and the elements of the torts convinced to a jury or to a judge. So no, nothing that happens in these criminal proceedings can be used unless it has to do with the believability of a witness.
Dave, one final thought before we take off.
My only final thought would be that I think that this case as a whole has exposed a great deal about some of the challenges we have in Baltimore, and we've seen Baltimore in many ways respond positively with some really necessary and important reforms, and I'm hoping that we continue to move forward on those.
Well, thank you all very much, gentlemen. Good to see you, and I appreciate your time. Edward Smith is an attorney in private practice. He served in the office of the state's attorney, and he's argued cases in front of the Supreme Court. David Jaros is an associate professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law. They join us here on Maryland Morning periodically to help us unpack the legal dimensions of the trials of all of the officers who are facing charges in the arrest and death of Freddie Gray. Kenneth Burns is WIPR's Metro reporter. The next trial is scheduled for Lieutenant Brian Rice. He's the highest-ranking officer indicted in the arrest of Freddie Gray. He's charged with five counts, including second-degree assault and involuntary manslaughter. His trial is scheduled to begin a week from Tuesday on July 5th. Kenny Burns will be there, and we'll keep you up with all the developments as these trials proceed. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, the other verdict that came down yesterday, the verdict delivered by the voters of Great Britain who voted to leave the European Union. We'll talk about the geopolitical ramifications of the Brexit vote with an expert in international relations.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Yesterday, voters in Britain voted decisively to leave the European Union. So to discuss the impact that this decision might have in the U.S., we turn to Sydney Van Morgan. She is the director of the International Studies Program and senior lecturer in the Department of Sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Professor, good morning. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So your reaction to this vote that seems to have taken a bunch of people by surprise.
It's quite stunning. You know, most observers were predicting that the Remain campaign would win the referendum. It didn't. And now everybody's scrambling to figure out what this is going to mean.
The stock market at the moment, Dow Jones down about 425 points. The German index down almost 7. The Hong Kong index down almost 3. The Japan index down almost 8. The London index, interestingly enough, down less than the others, down about 4%. Mm-hmm. So this has certainly had an impact in the global markets. What do you think the impact's going to be just in terms of the geopolitical situation and Britain's relationship with the U.S., Britain's relationship with Europe, and it's not only its allies, but its opponents.
Right. I think it's going to take some time to figure that out. Britain is now going to enter into an extended period of negotiating its exit from the European Union. It is going to have to renegotiate a number of treaties, not just with the European Union, but also with partners like the United States. And it's going to take quite a bit of time to figure out what the parameters of those agreements are going to be and how that's going to impact the country internally and both in terms of its and in terms of its external relationships. You know, I think internally, the position of Scotland in the Union is going to be a question that a lot of people are going to be sort of raising again.
Scotland voted overwhelmingly to stay.
To stay.
I mean, the folks who voted to stay were the people in the city of London, the people in the city of Birmingham,
right,
and everybody in Scotland.
And Scotland, yeah. So the Scottish politicians are already talking about the possibility of a second referendum on Scottish membership in the United Kingdom. But I think more generally, the EU has to worry about other countries looking at Britain, other member states of the European Union looking at Britain and saying, can we do this too?
Is this indicative of a growing trend towards isolationism and particularly anti-immigration? I emailed a friend of mine who lives in London this morning, and he had volunteered in the Remain campaign. He's a supporter of Remaining. And I asked him if he found any parallels between Nigel Farage, who is leading the Remain campaign, and Donald Trump, who talks about immigration in a very similar way. And my friend, whose name is Alistair Bruton, said Brexit and Trump seem to be powered by very similar demographics and resentment. He says, so if you think that Trump couldn't win, watch out. What we found here in Britain is that there are a lot of very angry people out there, cross about immigration, pumped up with nationalist pride and fed up with seeing none of the benefits of economic growth, who now are determined to make the rest of us listen.
It's a great question. As you may know, Donald Trump was already speaking this morning about the impact of this vote.
And ironically,
he's in Scotland congratulating Britain on the outcome. And I would not be surprised if his campaign exploits this to support his more isolationist perspective, approach, and some of the other arguments that he's making about migration. It's going to be fascinating to see how that
Will others in Europe also exploit this? I mean, there's already been a call by people on the right in France and people on the right in Portugal, I think, to have a vote similar to this to try to get them to leave too. What's the status of the EU?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the EU is going to be hearing from its member states, and it's going to be looking to Britain and potentially trying to imitate this outcome and at least exploiting some of the arguments that were made to support the Leave campaign. Again, a lot is going to be determined by these agreements, the agreement that's going to have to be hashed out over the next 2 years. The free movement of people across Europe is one of the sort of fundamental principles of European integration. And there's going to be some really interesting discussions about the future of that principle, given this outcome.
Yeah, I misspoke. It's not Portugal. It's talking about taking a vote. It's the Netherlands.
France,
the Netherlands saying, let's have a vote of our own here.
Yep. Yeah. Yep, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see other countries doing the same very, very soon.
Could this be the beginning of the slippery slope for the dissolution of the European Union?
I think the EU has to take this very seriously, and I would not be surprised if they attempt to implement some reforms. I think a lot of people on both sides of this debate have been calling for reform in the European Union for a long time. This is their opportunity to say we understand what some of the complaints have been and to, you know, readjust their policies and their treaties. Very difficult thing to do in the European Union, given the number of players. But I think the EU is going to have to reform lest it see more Brexits in the future.
This is a long process. David Cameron announced that he will resign as prime minister, but not until October.
Right.
And he basically says, I'm not the guy to shepherd through this exit, this extrication between Britain and the EU. And then that's going to take a couple mm-hmm. of years, perhaps. So this is going to be a long time. What needs to happen? I mean, the EU obviously isn't going to make this easy for Britain because they don't want to encourage anybody else to do the same thing.
That's right. So Britain is going to try to negotiate the best deals that it can for the UK, and the EU is going to try to negotiate the worst deal that it can for the UK because they don't want to embolden other countries, other leave movements. And so that is going to be a very interesting dance between, again, these various players. What Britain wants, or what the Leave campaign wants, is something like what Norway has, which is access to the common market, but without membership in the European Union. But the European Union is not going to want to encourage other countries to do what Britain just did.
This ain't going to be easy.
Sydney, it's going to be tough.
Sydney Van Morgan is the Director of International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you for coming in. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
That's it for us today. Maryland Morning's director, engineer, and co-host is Nathan Sterner. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill, with production assistance from Lauren Ferguson. Shane Raphael is our intern. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Maryland Morning theme music. Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. You can check them out online at zekescoffee.com. Coming up Monday, the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies is getting new leadership. The founding executive director, Dr. Christopher Layton, is stepping aside this month. He'll join me, along with scholars from the Institute, for Living Questions, our monthly series on religion in the public sphere, to talk about the changing profile of religion and the expanding portfolio of the ICJS. Plus, we'll have a preview of the African American Festival, which gets underway next weekend at Camden Yards. Hope you can join us Monday morning here on Maryland Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great weekend.